Neon Project with Mike and Jay. The following is a past episode of an early incarnation of this program. During this episode, Mike and Jay speak with geologist, investigator, author, Scott Walter. Scott shares his insight in the controversial Kensington Runestone, as well as his historical investigations into pre-Columbian explorers of the Americas. He sheds light and information on little-known portions of our early history. Join us for this retro show and a look into the world of lost history. And just remember, the truth exists. Believe it. Live from the WNRI studios, perched high atop the banks of the majestic Peters River. Greetings from the jewel of the Blackstone Valley, Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Welcome to The Darker Side with Mike and Jay.
Welcome to a very special episode of The Darker Side.
Absolutely. Welcome, Mike.
Well, welcome, Jay.
Are you excited to be here this evening?
I'm excited to be here every time we have a show.
You know, just the fact that I'm looking at you makes me excited.
Well, I don't want to hear about that because this is a family program.
Oh, okay. So you know what? I think we're going to jump right into it tonight.
Yeah, normally we have some witty repartee, some things that some non sequiturs here and again. But today we're going to jump right into it because we have a very special guest today.
Absolutely. So let me just go here for those of you listening.
Let's go here.
I'm going to start like this. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And as we all know, that is the beginning of a famous rhyme that we all learned as kids.
You didn't make that one up?
I did not make that up.
Oh.
Actually, I'm not good at making things up on the fly,
no.
So I didn't make that up. Since childhood, we've been basically conditioned to answer the question as, who discovered America? And with Christopher Columbus, that's our basic answer normally.
That is the answer.
And you ask any kid nowadays, you know, what the answer is, and that's pretty much what they would tell you.
Mm-hmm.
However, tonight we're going to have a little bit of a twist on that. So here on the Darker Side, we're definitely on a quest for knowledge and a search for the truth. And I think we talk about that a lot. The name of the show is The Darker Side. However, we attempt to fight away the darkness of certain aspects of
fight it away
reality and try to bring truisms of not only history, but other things that,
normally,
come forth in the universe.
Normally our show is dedicated towards some of the darker sides of life, you know, paranormal events and things of that sort. But tonight it's a little bit different. We're going to be speaking about lost history.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be speaking about geology. We're going to be speaking about a lot of different things that we don't normally talk about.
Correct. So the Columbus myth, it's been perpetuated for years, and obviously it's deeply rooted in our lessons of early American history. As with the early Viking explorers that we know, or some of us may not know, they settled in Greenland 500 years before Columbus. You know, obviously Columbus sailed to the New World in 1492. However, obviously it's been a long time since I've been in school, but
yeah?
I don't know if they're teaching the Viking history of early America.
I don't know if it's in the textbooks, but I'm sure that they do mention at least Greenland,
right,
as being a landing spot for the Vikings.
I think it needs to be more than a mention.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the Vikings settled in Greenland 500 years before Columbus. So tonight we'll turn history on its head, and I think you'll really, really enjoy the show. So we have a special treat tonight. So we only have an hour, as everyone knows, and when Mike and I are talking on our own, the hour goes by relatively quickly. So I think tonight with the guests that we have, it'll go by even faster. So we're going to get right into it. Our special guest tonight is a gentleman by the name of Scott Walter. And Scott Walter is a geologist and an expert in the Kensington Runestone, which, if you haven't heard about it, it's something that we'll be elaborating a little bit more on tonight. And he's written two books on the subject. The first one is entitled The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. And his latest work, Hooked X, Key to the Secret History of North America, which I've just recently completed. And actually, it took me a while to get the book because the first print was
sold out.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's a good sign.
It took me a couple weeks to get it, to get the actual print of that. Anyway, it was also the basis of a recent show on the History Channel, which some of you may or may not have caught, and it was called Holy Grail in America, which Scott was featured prominently in. That I've I actually watched it 4 or 5 times, to be quite honest with you.
Yeah, it's good. Very good program.
I mean, the first time I was...
Trying to absorb everything.
Exactly.
Right.
It was... I found it very interesting. The first time, however, I was trying to... absorb some more information.
Well, part of the problem is that everybody on that program is much smarter than we are, so it takes us a little bit more time to get it.
Exactly. So I think we're going to go to Scott here now, because Scott is on the line this evening. Sir, are you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you doing, guys?
Good. How you doing tonight?
Good, good.
Oh, we certainly appreciate you coming. Oh, we've got a dog in the background.
Chris!
That's a ghost dog.
That's my own dog. It doesn't recognize my voice. Sorry about that.
That sounds is it a schnauzer or perhaps
he's a mini dachshund, and I'll tell you what, he may be small, but he's pretty tough.
Oh, yeah, the dachshunds are known to be for their ferocity.
Ankle biters, yeah.
Well, sir, we certainly appreciate you lending your time to us tonight and sharing your knowledge with us. You know, obviously, we appreciate you coming on tonight, so thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I mentioned that you are a geologist by trade, but if maybe you can give us a little more on your background and how you get started in the field, and maybe talk a little bit about what you do when you're not writing or lecturing about the Kensington Runestone.
Sure. Well, I'm a geologist by education, and thankfully, I've been fortunate to carve out a living in the profession that I love. I love geology.
No pun intended, right?
well, maybe a little. No, but I run a laboratory in St. Paul. The name of the company is American Petrographic Services. Thanks for letting me plug that.
No problem.
And what we do is what we call material forensics, but I think the layperson would understand what we do is we perform autopsies on concrete and rock.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, that's what we do. We get samples in from all over the country, sometimes from other countries and other continents, and what we'll do is we'll literally perform an autopsy. We'll cut these samples up, we'll create different types of samples, and then we will document different aspects of the material to try to figure out why the concrete had low strength, why it cracked, why the top came off, whatever. Whatever the case may be, we also look at rock. Typically, we're looking at different aggregate sources for use in concrete, mm-hmm. but oftentimes we'll look at building stone, and every once in a while we'll get something unusual that comes in. And in July of 2000, my life changed when the Kensington Runestone was brought into our lab, and we performed a forensic analysis on that artifact.
We're going to get into that in a minute, but did you not also perform an investigation on the concrete from the Pentagon during the the September 11th attacks also?
Yes, we did. We were assigned to that project a few days afterward, and we performed forensic analysis on all of the structural concrete that had been damaged by fire or heat.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really an incredible project, and it was an honor to be involved in that. And
well, it's got to be a little different from what you normally would be involved with. And
well, we've looked at fire-damaged concrete before, but never from a jet fuel fire related to a terrorist attack, and hopefully that'll never happen.
Hopefully
again.
That's it, right?
Yep, that's the one and only time.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a show on its own, so we'll put that on the back burner tonight.
Right.
Sure. That was an interesting project.
Hmm. So I think one of our missions here on the show is to try to shed a little bit of light on some obscure elements of history in the real truth about some of the things that go on in the universe. And obviously tonight's topic is right up this alley, and we hope to help you in. Because I know, Scott, you're out there trying to, you're out there, talking about some of the things that you've researched, and we want to kind of rewrite the history books. And I mean, obviously, we're just a small radio program here, but we start with trying to get some of the information out there, especially some of the stuff that you've uncovered in your investigations.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, every little bit helps, and.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has been really an eye-opening experience for me because I had never interacted with certain disciplines that are heavily involved in this diffusion topic or pre-Columbian historical controversial history. And it was an eye-opener from the standpoint that when I reached my first conclusions or first opinions about the weathering of the inscription, which to me was clearly old,
mm-hmm.
I was shocked by how people from these other disciplines like archaeology and history and language and anthropology basically looked at me with this glazed look and said, well, that's very interesting, but this thing's a fake, don't you know?
Right.
And I said, well, no, it's not. The weathering is old, therefore it can't be the late 19th century hoax that you guys have claimed that it was. And you know, to be honest with you, at the time, I really didn't understand and really think about it much as to what these conclusions meant. And, you know, like you guys have said, it really demands that the history that we've all sort of been taught and thought was right was not right. Mm-hmm. And, again, I didn't think about that at the time, but I started to think about it when I had people that were outside my discipline of geology challenge my findings. And this was bizarre to me, and that's really what sort of opened my eyes to it and then led me to go, okay, what's going on here? And that's what I've been doing for the last almost 10 years now.
Right. Well, for our listeners who are not quite familiar with what we're talking about or our topic tonight, maybe you can give us a obviously, you know, we only have an hour, so maybe we can give
sure.
us a condensed version of what the Kensington Runestone is and
okay.
how you got involved with it.
Sure, sure, I can do that. Well, the Kensington Runestone is a tombstone, kind of a typical tombstone-sized slab of rock that was found by a Swedish immigrant farmer by the name of Olof Åhman,
mm-hmm.
who in 1898, on a farm near Kensington, Minnesota, which is the west central part of the state, was clearing trees in preparation for farming. And when he tipped over with a winch this roughly 25 to 30 year old tree, he and his two sons, when the tree came down, tightly wrapped in the roots of that tree was this 202 pound stone. And on the stone was a long inscription carved in runes, the language of the Old Norse,
mm-hmm.
that basically talked about an exploration or acquisition actually far to the west of Vinland, and it has a very long and interesting inscription. I can tell you what it says if you want.
Oh, please, yes.
Yeah, basically what it says, and this is based on a translation that was put forth by my co-author in a book that we wrote together in 2005 called The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick Nielsen's translation basically says, 8 Goths or Gutter and 22 Norwegians on this acquisition business far to the west of Vinland. We had camped near 2 shelters, 1 day's journey north from the stone. We were fishing one day. When we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death. And then there's 3 Latin letters that say AVM, which is probably a prayer prompt of one type or another.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, save from evils. That's on the face side. On the split side of the stone, there are 3 more lines that says, there are 10 men by the sea with our ships, 14 days journey from this island, year 1362, which of course is 130 years before Columbus.
Right.
And that's the latest translation of the stone.
So obviously that's pretty groundbreaking.
Ahead.
I'm sorry, I would say just on the face of it, just that part has got to be, you know, to any student of history, just astounding to hear that and to have that translated.
Well, yeah, and you know, people talk about Christopher Columbus for such a long time who didn't even make it to the mainland of North America, and 130 years earlier, it seems fantastic that you've got a party of 30 people, you know, halfway across the continent. I mean, this, to many people, just didn't fit in their brains very well, and they obviously didn't accept it. So.
Right. Maybe we can talk a little bit about Olof Åhman and who he was personally, and give a little background on him, because I know that one of the things, and trust me, I certainly go along with a lot of the theories and some of the things that you've researched. However, one of the things that bothered me initially when I heard the story probably about a year ago was the fact that Olof Åhman himself was he Norwegian or was he Scandinavian of that descent?
He you know what? That's a great point. He was Swedish.
Right.
And he immigrated from a very small town about 2.5 hours north of Stockholm, Sweden, if you can imagine that, a coastal city called Hudiksvall and a little parish called Forsadalen Parish. And, you know, I have to admit, when I first became involved in this thing and started to learn about him and, you know, the whole story, I was I kind of went, that's interesting. It's
right.
Carved in old Swedish, and he's a Swedish immigrant.
You know?
Now, that in itself is interesting, but it doesn't prove anything.
Right.
But I did kind of pause for a second and say, that's interesting.
Right. I mean, like I said, I mean, that was one of the things I'm like, okay, well, it's...
Would he have had access to that? To that information,
exactly.
Though, I mean, would he know? And I think we're going to probably talk about that in a little bit. But there's some specific characteristics of some of the runes that were on there that would not have been known to him.
Exactly. Well, you know, Olaf Oman was not formally educated. I think he had the equivalent of about a second grade formal education. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't a bright man.
Right.
He was a very smart man and clever, but he wasn't that clever to be able to carve that. And one of the things that he said that really rang true with me after the stone was found and a lot of the accusations started, he says, I know what runes are. Every kid that's, you know, raised in Sweden knows about their Norse Viking heritage and has heard about runes, but he said, I don't know how to use them.
Right.
And, you know, that seemed really... straightforward to me and honest. I mean, he said, look, I know what they are, but I don't know how to use them. And,
right.
You know, he could have, if there was something funny going on, you'd probably expect a response like, well, I don't know what those are. I don't know how to use them.
Right.
More of a defensive thing. But when you read his letters and his words, he comes across as being a straight-up guy.
Now, was he trying to, was there any financial gain on his part as a result of the discovery?
No. No. And you know, the funny thing about the history of the stone, which, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to understand, there's a lot of misconceptions, a lot of myths that it's like a lot of famous stories. Most of the things that you've heard are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of them. You know, they said, well, Olaf sold the stone to Helmer Holland in 1907. And he didn't. He gave it to him. And he said, look, you're just as poor as me, so... you want to study this thing, go ahead and take it, and when you're done, give it to the Minnesota Historical Society. So he never profited. In fact, his family suffered terribly over the years from the ridicule and the accusations. He had 9 children, and 2 of those children committed suicide. One of them was quite ill. We don't think it had anything to do with the runestone, but the oldest daughter, Amanda, definitely... we think in part was due to the harassment that the family received. And the family today agrees with that assessment. So it was tough on the family, very tough.
Scott, one of the things I'd like to get your opinion on, and, you know, just feel free to answer as you feel, but why do you think a lot of, you know, mainstream scientists and researchers today and over the years are so set in their ways and have a hard time accepting alternative theories about our history and trying to rewrite history when we have, obviously, we have more information nowadays than what we have at any time previous?
Well, I think the problem then and today boils down to a couple of things. First of all, I think the fact of the matter is these people that are experts in these various disciplines, as I mentioned before, history, language, archaeology, anthropology, do not receive formal training in scientific method. And basically, scientific method is the process of solving a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that in my forensic business I use every day because as a geologist, I was formally trained in this. And I would have to say that when I look back on the investigations of the past, I see mistakes made in the lack of employing proper scientific methods. So that's the first thing.
Right.
But the second thing, I guess I would categorize it as the fallibilities of the human condition. And I'm talking about arrogance. I'm talking about laziness. I'm talking about people trying to protect their positions and both their positions within institutions and their positions and their theories that they have put forth. And, you know, if this thing turns out to be real, I'm talking about from their perspective because it absolutely is real, some of the work and the papers and the things that they have done, the research they've done, suddenly become irrelevant or wrong. And, you know, they're very protective of those positions and their status. So I think that's a big part of it. But I guess the other thing that, I'm hopeful to get out there, if there are any academics listening, many of these people that I've debated with call themselves scientists. And, you know, I talked about the lack of scientific method. But the other thing that people forget is that if new evidence comes forth, like the evidence that we put forth in these two books, including the Hooked X we just put out, but if new evidence comes forth that is consistent with a new conclusion, you go there.
Right.
I haven't done this a lot in my career, but I have done it a few times, and I don't think that's having to admit that you were wrong or you were stupid. I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's a smart thing to do. So these people that are out there trying to defend a position, hey, we've got a whole new data set here. You don't have to admit you were wrong. Look at the data and go where it takes you.
So for the people who think that this is just some sort of haphazard idea that you came up with, I mean, all you have to do is read the books that you've come out with and know that your research is quite thorough and your investigations are quite thorough as well.
Well, I tried to be, and, you know, I think especially in this particular arena, I've certainly learned that after, you know, almost 10 years of being involved in it. The old phrase, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof, applies, I think, in this case. So I've literally tried to leave no stone unturned and gone after everything I can. And one of the things that I always look at is, hey, here's one interpretation of this data set here, but is there another possibility? Could there be something here that doesn't fit together? And I've tried to do that. But the one thing that I think you have to understand, it's kind of like a murder mystery that you watch on television. As you watch the show, they give you bits and pieces of clues and evidence, and, you know, it doesn't make sense until finally, aha, this is the person that did it, and then everything falls into place. Well, that's the same thing that happens when we do our work, forensic work. Once you're on the right track, all these, you know, pieces suddenly fit together, as they must if you're on the right track.
So to close out the Kensington Runestone for now, can you give us a concise, basically a conclusion as to what you discovered in terms of your impartial investigation of the stone itself?
Well, if you want to talk just about the geologic work that I did, basically I compared the weathering of the inscription on the Kensington Stone with tombstones that I took samples off of with permission in Maine. And essentially what happened is I was able to conclude that the weathering of the runestone is older than 200 years.
Right.
And that's all I can say. And that's from 1898 when it was first pulled out of the ground, because it hasn't been in a weathering environment since. It's been in a museum. And so the claim that it's a late 19th century hoax is impossible.
Right.
So if it's not a hoax, then what is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, really the only plausible explanation you have is that it must be genuine. But once you say that, then there's a whole bunch of other things that must also be so if it's a genuine article made in the 14th century. And so from there we went on and started to look at those things, and we found everything.
I think we're really interested in following kind of the same progression that you followed in, you know, the History Channel show Holy Grail in America, which obviously was a compelling show. I was saying in the intro, I've watched a couple times since the initial broadcast. But so once you wrote your book on the Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence, where did you go from there? Actually, how did you continue on, and where did you go from that point?
Okay. Well, that's... that was interesting. And after the Kensington Stone book was done, there was really only one thing left that Dick and I really were not able to get to the bottom of, and nobody else did either.
Mm-hmm.
And that was this mysterious symbol being used for the A sound called the Hooked X. And it's a simple X symbol that has an extra little stroke on the upper right-hand arm of the X, and This had never been seen anywhere before in a medieval runic inscription or anywhere for that matter, except on four more runestones that were found on the east coast of North America. There were three stones found at Spirit Pond, Maine in 1971. They were found in a cluster together. And then, and what's neat about those stones is one of them is a map of that area of Spirit Pond where the Kennebec River meets the Atlantic Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And on the map, it actually says Vinland takes 2 days with an arrow pointing to the right when you hold the map up and read it. But actually to the right, which everybody would normally think would be east on a map, with north at the top, is actually south because many medieval maps, most medieval maps, had east at the top.
Right.
So to the right would have been south, which is another feature that's consistent with it being medieval. But when you sail 2 days south from Spirit Pond, Maine, you end up in the Cape Cod Narragansett Bay area. And funny, about 5 miles in to Narragansett Bay on the western shoreline, there's a boulder that has another runic inscription with the hooked X. So now you have five runestones found in North America that all have the hooked X and many other interesting features that tie them together, but they have enough unique features that, you know, they were made by different parties, but it appears that they were all part of the same group or medieval order.
Hmm. So they were all using the same methodologies as far as inscribing their runes, and that's what makes them unique and indicative of... You're not suggesting that it's the same people, but they're of the same group. Type.
No, not the same party, because the Spirit Pond stones are also dated to 1401, 1402, which is 39 and 40 years from the Kensington stone. So they were apparently carved later. But because the hooked X, which turns out, I think, to be their symbol, representative of their ideology and perhaps some other things, but that really is their mark, which to me connects them together. Even though it's not the same people, they represented the same group that embraced the same ideologies and thoughts.
I think one of the pieces of information that was really compelling to me, and maybe we can talk a little bit about Prince Henry Sinclair himself and his party, but his flag that he sailed under, and it's a similarity to the Mi'kmaq people, I believe, of Maine, the Native American people, and how similar their...
Nova Scotia.
Okay, and how similar their flags were. Can you talk a little bit about Prince Henry and his, maybe his quote-unquote legend of him sailing across the Atlantic?
Right. Well, I actually came across Prince Henry from a couple different angles, but... Mm-hmm. I just used kind of a simple logic from the standpoint that 1401, 1402, who could have carved these? And according to standard academics, they say nobody was here before Columbus. Well, okay, so we don't really have any candidates, except I did hear a lot about this man, Prince Henry Sinclair, who was an earl in Orkney in Scotland and a very prominent person who was a sailor and a navigator who reportedly came over to the New World in 1398. So I said, well, I don't have any other candidates, so let's take a look at him. And it was very interesting when we started delving into the history of the Sinclair clan, who reportedly are the hereditary grand masters of a military monastic order called the Knights Templar.
Mm-hmm.
And this became a very interesting connection, because one of the things we concluded about the carver of the Kensington runestone was that it had to be a Cistercian monk, because all the language, dialect, runes, grammar features, dating features, all took us to the island of Gotland, which was a part of Sweden. And the only clergy you had on the island at that time were the Cistercians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, interestingly enough, the Cistercians created the Knights Templar order, essentially, created the Knights Templar Order in 1128, and they were tied together hand in glove ideologically. So here's another connection, and if the Sinclairs are reportedly the hereditary Grand Masters of the Knights Templar, then there has to be a connection with the Cistercians. So you have all this smoke that's billowing, and you know that old phrase, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Right.
So there seemed to be a connection there. Now, there isn't any tangible evidence that directly connects Prince Henry Sinclair, but the circumstantial evidence really leaves him as the only plausible candidate.
Well, like I said earlier, the Mi'kmaq flag, as it relates to the Prince Henry's flag,
right,
is very, very interesting. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's it's very interesting. As you can imagine, you get when you start to get out there with this research, you have a lot of people that, you know, support you and people that don't support you. But one of the people who have embraced this research, for obvious reasons, is the Sinclair clan. And Niven Sinclair, who's really the patriarch of the Sinclair clan, I've become friends with, and he shared a lot of information with me. And one of the things that he pointed out was the similarity of the Mi'kmaq flag with this Sinclair or Knights Templar battle flag. And really, it's the same flag in that it has a red cross kind of laying on its side with the long horizontal and the short vertical line. But in the upper and lower quadrants on the left side, you have a five-pointed star and then a crescent that looks like the moon, except it's actually the symbol for Venus, because if you look at Venus in the night sky with a telescope or a spotting scope, it looks like it's round, but it's actually a crescent. And the tips are up, whereas the moon, the tips are either to the right or to the left. And this is what we have on the Templar battle flag. And on the Mi'kmaq flag, you have the two reversed. The five-pointed star is in the lower quadrant, and the crescent with the tips up is in the upper quadrant. I mean, it's exactly a mirror image, identical to the Knights Templar battle flag. So I guess the obvious question is that a coincidence?
Right. Well, it would be quite a coincidence if it was.
That's pushing it for me. I'm sorry. I don't buy that one.
It's one of the things that you start, you know, once you start connecting the dots and looking at all the information, it's like, you cannot dismiss that as just mere coincidence. I mean, obviously, there's some merit to that particular theory.
Well, you know, in when we do our forensic work, we look at these things, and what we conclude is this consistent with this thesis, or is it not? And this is one of those these things that is really consistent. So as you start to build up these consistencies, as they start to pile on top of each other, you know, I guess you have to, you know, let people decide for themselves if they think that you're on the right track or not. I mean, I know what I think, but it's really for other people to read and decide for themselves. But so far, the consensus has been positive.
Just speaking really quickly about the Native American tribes that may have had interactions with these parties that were coming over, they have a long tradition of oral history and things of that sort. Is there anything in the known record of these tribes that would indicate that they had interactions with Europeans or Scandinavians, I should say, before Columbus?
Well, the answer is yes. First off, they have a legend called the Legend of Glooskap, which talks about early contact. We're not sure exactly who these white people were that they talk about, but many people believe it's Prince Henry Sinclair. And I'm really glad that you brought up the whole Native American question, because I've thought about this for a long time, and I've always been disappointed in people who said, "Wow, gee, the Native Americans have this oral tradition, and it's like the telephone game." And I mean, that's just an insulting thing to say, because I've reached out to some Native American tribes, and I always thought that if you just treated them with respect and you know, asked them questions, they might respond, and that's exactly what's happened. But one of the things that was just incredible that happened to me a little over a year ago, I was speaking at a conference in Nova Scotia called the Atlantic Conference, and I gave my presentation about the Kensington Runestone. And when I got done, a woman came up to me who was introduced to me as the keeper of the prophecies within the Ojibwa in Ontario. And she was a member of a secret society within the Native Americans called the Madewin. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Scott, we know all about your people that were here in the 14th century. And I said, you do? I kind of looked at her, and she just had that knowing smile on her face, and she said, oh, yes. I said, well, how do you know that? And she said, we remember that because half our people died. I went, really? She said, they brought the plague.
Oh, yeah.
And it just suddenly struck me that, wow. Well, first off, if half your people died, if you have any type of record, whether it's oral or written or both, that would be something you'd probably remember about your history.
Right.
And the other thing that struck me was that if you look at the Kensington inscription, at one point it says, 10 men red with blood and death. And this is often back in at that time. And this is shortly after the plague was ravaging through Europe, starting in 1348, 1349. That's how people stricken with plague were often described. So. And I think there is some record of mass population reductions in the Native American cultures, certainly over in Europe around this time, because of the plague and maybe smallpox and some others. But, you know, this is something that people should be looking at. And, again, talk to the natives. Let's mm-hmm. see what they know. Treat them with respect, and,
right.
and maybe they'll help us out.
I think talking about their oral history, I think it's one of the things about our own history that people tend to be arrogant about, and that you know, that's the history that we don't have. You know, we're not giving credibility to other cultures in terms of how they relate their history to, you know, future generations.
Right. That might be just how they record their history. Doesn't mean it's not right.
Right.
Well, that's right. And remember one other thing. You know, when these oral histories are passed down, and by the way, some of these Native American groups did write things down. They recorded things sometimes on birch bark, on animal skins, and carved on rock. Not necessarily inscriptions, but symbols. But when they transferred oral information, whether it's through sweat lodge or other ceremonies, it was, the best way I can describe it was a multi-sensory experience. In other words, first of all, you were chosen, and it was a great honor for you to receive this information.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you were probably starved yourself. You know, most of them were fasting for a number of days, and then you go into sweat lodge, and there's this heat, and there's light, and there's darkness. You know, it's kind of like I use the analogy, does a woman remember when she gave birth? Well, of course she does. I mean, she was in pain, it was joy,
right.
It was, you know, all these, it's a multi-sensory thing. So when you get this information, it sure as hell isn't the telephone game.
Right.
This is something beyond that. And so I think they did a pretty good job of remembering this and passing it on. You know,
mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Well, to go back to the Cistercians, if I may,
yeah.
And I find them very interesting. And I sent you obviously one of the emails leading up to the program tonight, talking about the Cistercian monastery here, right in our own backyard.
Right, right, right.
And I sent Janet some pictures of some of the things that I found there. I happened to stumble upon, and they may be something, they may not. I don't know if you've looked at them and what you think.
You know
think
what? I haven't seen them, and
oh.
Janet didn't say anything about it.
Put her on the spot, right?
Uh-oh.
Maybe she's hogging the pictures or something. I don't know.
Sorry about that.
But I haven't seen them. I'm sorry.
No, what it is, basically, up in Cumberland, Rhode Island, which is the next town over from where we're broadcasting tonight, there's an old Cistercian monastery that actually... part of it burnt down in 1950. There was a fire there, and part of the old church burnt down. And subsequently, the town of Cumberland took over the property, and they built a public library attached to the building. However, there's still an old structure that is still erect, and also
huh.
yes, and also the property itself, which we've been out there before, it has quite a history.
Yeah, there's other things besides the Cistercian monastery. It's actually the site of the oldest veterans memorial in the country. It was
right.
From King Philip's War in the 1600s.
Right.
Oh, really? Okay, that's
and
interesting.
I just happened to be in the library one day with my son, who's 2 years old, and he likes to ride elevators. And we get on the elevator, we went up to the second floor, and happened to wander through one of the old hallways that attaches the new part of the building to the old Cistercian monastery.
Okay.
And right in the middle of the floor, inlaid in the tile, which obviously you can tell is original tile, is a is a cross with a circle around, actually two circles, one around the outside edge of the cross and a smaller circle on the inside. And it was very reminiscent to me of different Knights Templar crosses that I've seen in the past. So I don't know what kind of other history that the place has, but I found that very interesting. I didn't know if maybe it merited some other some other looks into looking about the history of that place.
Did you send Jan a picture of that?
I certainly did. Yes.
All right, as soon as we get off, I'm going to go have a talk with her.
I don't mean to drop the dime on
her. No. You know what? She's pretty good about that. Maybe the email didn't go through. But anyway, you know what? There might be something there. I don't know if some of the information that we talked about in the Hooked X that would be attributed to the Cistercians in the medieval times was passed down to modern Cistercian order, and they're still around.
Right.
Oh, by the way, I have a question. Was the old part of the monastery built in stone?
Yes.
Wood?
Stone.
It was built in stone.
Correct.
Well, I would think so, because building in stone was considered to be a high privilege and an honor, and the stonemasons back in medieval times were, you know, they were kind of considered the rock stars of their day.
Right.
They were, you know, and to build a religious structure, whether it was a church, a monastery, or a cathedral, was the highest honor that they could do. And that's why when you go into these places, especially over in Europe, and you see the exquisite stonework and masonry that was done, you know, you understand why, because to them, this was the greatest thing that they could possibly do. And I'll tell you what, they did one amazing job. But, you know, and that's the other thing, too, that's so interesting. When I talk to skeptics, they talk about these people like they're stupid or something and that they couldn't possibly have gotten over here. And,
right.
And the more I learn about the Cistercians, about the Knights Templar, and just many of these other people of ancient times, boy, one thing, do not underestimate them.
Right.
And getting over here to North America really, in many ways, was no big deal at all.
Well, one of the things that, Scott, if we could move on, we're rapidly running short of time, but obviously a riveting conversation, but we do broadcast from Rhode Island, and you mentioned that there was a stone found in Narragansett Bay. And then also another very interesting artifact, if you will, from that's located in Rhode Island, that would be the Newport Mystery Tower. Would you be able to just describe a little bit about how that's related?
Well, the Newport Tower, to me, is arguably the most important structure on this continent historically. I mean, this likely dates back to about 1400. It's a two-story tower built on eight columns in an octagonal pattern with a round cylinder on the second story, and it's all made out of indigenous or local stone there, both glacial boulders and some of the slate bedrock. And it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, some people believe it's a colonial windmill, which is really laughable in many regards. But what it is it's a medieval religious structure, a church, and an observatory. And it exhibits absolutely spot-on Knights Templar church, round church architecture, which goes back to the small two-story round tower on top of Christ's tomb inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where the original nine knights reportedly spent 9 years and brought this back. As soon as they came back from the Holy Land that first time, they started building churches with this architecture and then Romanesque arches between them. So the architecture alone absolutely just screams Templar. But what's amazing about this tower, which looks out over Narragansett Bay, is that it has numerous solar and lunar alignments that were first discovered and written about by a retired professor of physics and astronomy at University of Rhode Island, Bill Penhallow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the one that proposed a couple of years ago that if this was built by the Knights Templar, who would have had a high reverence for the planet Venus, which represented the physical manifestation of the goddess, which is something they would have also revered in the heavens, they should be in this tower. And sure enough, I found what looks to be the Venus alignment windows and niches inside that tower. And this is a pretty profound discovery, I think, because For me, what I tried to do is understand how did these people think, and what was it that was important to them. And then once I sort of understood that, then I went looking for what I knew had to be in this tower, because it would have been absolutely critical part of their religious beliefs to be in this structure. And sure enough, it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I think, to me, was one of the clinchers that this is absolutely a medieval structure. And I would have to say that I think that this needs to come to the attention of our politicians, so they can figure out a way to protect this structure, because
right.
it's in peril right now and it should be preserved.
And
absolutely.
I can tell you, as a almost a lifelong resident of Rhode Island, I've been by that tower before. And before you, if you don't know the story and you don't know the history behind it, you go right by it and you don't pay much attention
right.
to it. It's not really protected very well. There's that little, it's like a little wrought iron fence around it, if
a
I'm not mistaken.
Fence around it.
And yeah.
You know, and I'm not worried about people. I'm worried about the elements.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the enemy of that tower is water and freezing conditions, and it's slowly but surely falling apart. I don't know if it's going to fall down in our lifetime, but, you know, we're going to be gone before we know it, and the day is going to come when that tower is possibly going to collapse. And I really think we need to protect it, and I think once the final decision is made, they're going to realize what an important, incredible structure that is, really the first structure built by Europeans on this continent that predates, the Pilgrims by over 200 years.
One of the interesting things about it is, honestly, it is a tough little tower. I mean, during the Revolution, I think the British used it as a magazine, and then they tried to blow it up. Yeah, and then I think they took the top off of it. But
they took a little bit of the top off, but the tower took a licking, and it just keeps on ticking, you know?
You know, what's funny is we did a show on mysterious places in America a few months back, and we talked about the Newport Tower. However, we referred to it as, before I read your book, we referred to it as the Viking Tower. And I think after looking at your research, I'll never call it that again.
Yeah, we don't call it that anymore.
No, please don't, you know. But you know what's funny is that in a way you can kind of still say that with an asterisk, because one of the things about Prince Henry Sinclair and the Scottish Templars, the Sinclair clan intermarried with Norse royalty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with the kings and queens of Norway and Sweden for centuries. And so one of the things that I talk about in the book is that, you know, the Sinclairs and Prince Henry and the other Scottish Templars and who knows who else would certainly have gained that knowledge about the New World that, Norse royalty would have known about from mm-hmm. their Viking voyages. So in a way, there is a connection there.
What could be done, Scott, to prove the veracity of your conclusions with that? I mean, what type of testing would need to be done on the Newport Tower?
Well, I think first of all, what people need to do is they need to take the position that at the very least, it could be a medieval structure. Nobody has proven, nobody's put forth any evidence that it's not older than settlement, I mean, or from the colonial times. So when you have something that's an unknown, you err on the side of safety and you protect it. That's the first thing that needs to happen. And I think what also needs to happen is people who are so quick to just pass judgment and first of all say, hey, we've got a paradigm here. Nobody was here before Columbus. Therefore, that can't be older than colonial times.
Mm-hmm.
That has to go out the window. There are no such things as paradigms in history. All we have are facts. And once we collect enough facts, hopefully a picture is going to emerge. And I think what we need to do is take a step back. Because the Kensington Runestone, nobody's arguing with me that it's not a medieval artifact anymore. I mean, I haven't heard one argument from a skeptic in 4 years.
Right.
So if they were wrong about that, it begs the question, what else were they wrong about? Well, one of the things is the Newport Tower, all these runic inscriptions, and a whole host of other artifacts and sites. So what we need to do is take a step back and re-examine all of them. And until that examination is done, we need to protect them. And what's the harm in that? Who can argue with that logic?
I think, and that's the thing that boggles the mind. And I might have mentioned it earlier, but you know, scientists and historians and whatnot, they tend to be very narrow-minded about certain things. And you would think that they would be a little more open-minded and try to look at and get into the truisms of history.
Well, you know what, that one kind of puzzles me a little bit, because I thought the same thing mm-hmm. when I first got involved. But, you know, people are curious creatures, and I've seen a lot of people who will do anything and say anything to protect themselves. And unfortunately, that's part of the nature of the beast.
Right.
But I think we need to have people in positions of authority, like politicians. I mean, when they take up a cause, they can get state archaeologists and people within these educational institutions to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And really, and not to sound corny, but you know what it's like when politicians, when we start speaking up and asking questions, they straighten up and fly right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I appreciate being on your program and getting this information out there to a larger audience. I think the people of this country are interested in this, and they want the truth.
Right.
And if something is a question, then protect it and let's dig into it. Don't tell us what you think. I don't really care about academics' opinion unless they have evidence to support it.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to the tower and these other controversial artifacts, they don't have the facts.
Right.
So let the people decide. Do we care about these things? I think people do. And I think they want them protected. I think they want them studied objectively and honestly. And then let the chips fall where they may. I know where they're going to fall mm-hmm. on a lot of these things. But you have to take a step back. And I think the people of this country are the ones that ultimately have to decide, not these academics who, quite frankly, haven't done their jobs very well.
I think not only do you have to look at that, you know, take that approach with history, but basically anything that you might encounter, especially nowadays, you want to question things, and you want to try to get not take everything at face value, and you want to kind of look at and dig a little bit deeper and try to get to the you know, the truth of everything.
Well, that's a great point, and in our in our laws here in this country, I thought people were innocent until proven guilty. And I think the same applies here. You know, this tower could be old. And until we've proven one way or another, you have to assume that it is old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the position I would take. And, I mean, wouldn't it be a shame if we just let it go?
Right.
And in the future, they had some test they could just zap the tower and up. 1400 and we let it go to heck, you know. I
right.
mean, someday that might happen, and
right.
you know, I don't want to look back and say, gee, I wish we would have. I want to look back and say, boy, I'm glad we did.
Well, unfortunately, I think the hour is coming to a close here.
Yeah, rapidly.
Yeah, we.
I'm just getting started, guys. Come on.
Well, trust me, sir. I'd like to talk with you a whole lot more.
There's a whole lot of things we could get into. Unfortunately, we just don't have the time. But we wanted to give you an opportunity, Scott. Well, if members of our audience wanted to look into buying your books, where can they find them?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, the first one, the Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence, just go to www.kensingtonrunestone.com. And the new book, which is entitled The Hooked X, Key to the Secret History of North America, very simple,
mm-hmm.
www.hookedx.com.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
Well, like we said, Scott, you know, we certainly appreciate your work, and not only do we appreciate that, but we appreciate you being on the program with us tonight, and hopefully, well, actually, let me ask you this: what are you working on now, and where is your investigations taking you from this point?
Well, I think I'll just leave you with a tantalizing thought.
Oh, nice!
Right.
The Templars and the Cistercians who came to North America followed absolutely in the footsteps of people and cultures that came before them, long before them.
Mm.
So that's what we're working on. I'll leave you with one other thing.
Okay.
The Sinclair clan has a very extensive DNA project that they've worked on, and some of the native cultures in this continent have also done some DNA work.
Mm-hmm.
And if it isn't going to be found anywhere else, the truth of the history of this continent will be found in the blood, literally. So stay tuned on that.
Nice. Well, that's very tantalizing, but I don't think I can handle any more revelations for one day.
Hey, guys, I really appreciate you having me on. This is just great, and I appreciate you getting the word out there. And anytime you want to talk about anything else, just give me a call, and I'll be happy to do it.
Well, thank you very much. Much appreciated, sir. And our guest tonight has been Scott Walter, the book The Hooked X. Please check it out. And thank you again, Scott.
All right, Scott. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be in touch. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that hour went by way too quickly. We had lots of other things we could have talked about. Obviously, one of the a very compelling guest. I'm glad that we did this show.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, that was very interesting, and I hope you all enjoyed it, and we'd hope to get...
We wanted to get some calls, but, it was just... We wanted to get as much time with Scott as we could, and I'm sure that if we asked very politely, maybe he'd come on another time.
Right.
But we did want to quickly talk about the darker side moment, and that was earlier this week. If you go to www.nearparanormal.com, that's nearparanormal.com, you can see Mike and Jay being interviewed on Keith and Sandra Johnson's show, Ghosts Are Near.
That's right. We were on a TV show, and we have a face for radio, but a forehead for TV. I would just leave it at that. And you know what? You can join us next week for another exciting edition. So until then, just remember, the truth exists. Believe it.